Since its founding in 2015, Juul has exploded into the highest-selling e-cigarette on the market. It made its founders billionaires and wormed its way into the zeitgeist. It has also become the face of the youth vaping crisis. In 2018, the Surgeon General declared the staggering rise of e-cigarettes and the use among teens an epidemic. Data that year showed more than 3.6 million teens, including 1 in 5 high school students and 1 in 20 middle school students, used e-cigarettes. The following year, a series of deaths and severe lung injuries tied to vaping sounded even more alarm bells. And while we are now more aware of its threat, the vaping epidemic still rages. In the new book, The Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation, award-winning Bloomberg journalist Lauren Etter reveals the story of the business's unprecedented boom and the staggering damage it has caused. It's a great pleasure to welcome Lauren Etter to the roundtable this morning. Lauren, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
What brought you to this particular topic and this new wrinkle in the war against tobacco?
As an investigative reporter and a business reporter at Bloomberg, I write about all kinds of companies, big and small. And as Juul was in the news a lot with the lung injury epidemic and hearing about kids becoming addicted to the product, I wrote a story for a magazine, and I realized I was only scratching the surface on a much bigger topic about nicotine use in America, about the tobacco wars that had, you know, for many years in the 90s were so much in the news and had kind of gone quiet. And suddenly nicotine was at the forefront, and, you know, it involved a Silicon Valley company, which I just thought was really fascinating, seeing kind of the types of innovation coming out of Silicon Valley and all of that. So it just kind of drew me in, and I learned there was a fascinating story there.
So how much is Juul at the beginning of all of this? I mean, there are many companies that do this, but Juul was the biggie, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing is, so Juul launched in 2015, in the summer of 2015, and it really popped, of course. But before that, there had been several companies that had dabbled in e-cigarettes and had, you know, created a real market. But it wasn't until Juul hit the market that the industry exploded and the company just took off, and the product ended up getting into the hands of, you know, millions of teenagers.
One of the original ideas and the positive, what they hope were positive impacts, is that this would help people who were smokers quit cigarettes. Instead of using a cigarette, you would use this device, a project which was cooler and techier and hopefully less carcinogenic.
Absolutely. And really kind of the heart of the matter, which is, and why it's so controversial, is because there are 34 million adult smokers in the United States. And what we know to be true is that cigarettes kill their users, and cigarettes contribute, or the, you know, leading contributor to preventable death in America. And so there's actually a real public health problem that does need to be solved. So when James Monsees and Adam Bowen kind of launched their efforts in this field, they saw it as a harm reduction tool. This is something that could, like, wow, we have this huge public health problem. And why are people still being killed by cigarettes? And why do we have this product? And why hasn't it been innovated on in so many years? The cigarette has, of course, been around forever. And they realized that really there had been no innovation in the sector ever. They were still doing the same thing that, you know, essentially when Christopher Columbus discovered tobacco, which is, you know, rolling the shredded leaf into paper, lighting it on fire, and inhaling the smoke into your lungs. So it was kind of like this aha moment for them when they thought, wow, we can actually make a public health contribution. Mm-hmm. So certainly there's that aspect to it.
What is fascinating, and in reading the book, is that these two guys were at Stanford University. This was their final thesis project.
Yes. Yeah. So they essentially, their final thesis project was a precursor to Juul. It was a very early kind of design of an e-cigarette that they called Plume. And what it did, it was butane fired. It was this butane fired device that they put little pods, almost like Keurig coffee pods, but they were filled with tobacco, and they would heat the tobacco and you would inhale that vapor. So that's called a heated tobacco product. So you're not burning the tobacco. So you do reduce some of the combustion and, you know, therefore the potential harm. So they started with this heated tobacco product, and it was a really crappy product. It just, smokers found it didn't deliver enough nicotine, so it didn't give you that hit or that high that you're looking for when you're a smoker. It didn't satisfy them. And so they continued innovating and ultimately developed Juul, which is different. It's an electronic device that basically heats up a liquid nicotine solution. And that liquid nicotine is vaporized, and that's what you inhale into your lungs. You're essentially inhaling, they call it, everybody knows it as vapor, but it's actually an aerosol. You're inhaling a nicotine aerosol into your lungs. So the idea is that it is most likely safer than a cigarette because, again, you're not burning the tobacco leaf. But, you know, it's a very new technology. Like, there haven't been long-term clinical studies on the potential health effects of inhaling this aerosol into your lungs over long periods of time. So they entered into it at a time when it was very new. Technology still evolving, and they kind of just went forward from there. They basically hit the sweet spot when they developed Juul.
I have to say, Lauren, one of the things that really I just couldn't believe is that this product was launched in 2015, which really doesn't seem that long ago. And the impact that it's had in a relatively short period of time is quite extraordinary.
It really is, and it's almost a testament to the Silicon Valley model in a way, because it's like, here's this new cool product, let's just blast it out there and let's get it into the hands of as many people as we can. That's what Bird did with their scooters. You know, suddenly you're walking down American streets and there are scooters laying everywhere and you're like, where did these things even come from? Or that's, you know, any sort of new tech company, that is their model, which is to just blast the market. You know, they call it blitz scaling. And so that's exactly what Juul did. And that's what made this story so fascinating, is that they had this highly addictive product, nicotine, and they basically overlaid the blueprint of Silicon Valley on top of that. And that's sort of where this collision happens and really becomes problematic.
One of the things that you bring to light is that while they may want to say that you know, they were moving on from the very fraught background of what big tobacco was up against, you argue that they really studied the tobacco companies, their history, their business models, and the thought was, this is how we're going to move this forward.
Yeah. And again, like, just so many fascinating twists and turns in the story. And when I kind of tied together the historical threads of the tobacco industry with what James and Adam were doing, that's when it really kind of opened up this whole landscape to evaluate. And one of the things was that in the 1990s, like the heat of the tobacco wars, when like the tobacco companies were basically brought to the brink of survival, they were threatened with bankruptcy because the FDA came down on them and tried to regulate them, and they were essentially almost put out of business. And so all of these attorneys general were suing them, and there were all these, you know, product liability lawsuits, and they were just crushed with litigation and regulation risk. And so basically, as to settle all of these lawsuits, they entered into this, what they called the master settlement agreement, which had all these stipulations, and they paid billions of dollars to states to cover healthcare costs and stuff like that. But one of the things was that came out of this master settlement agreement was that all of the documents that the tobacco industry had been hoarding and hiding over the years needed to become public. And in that, in those documents, we're talking millions and millions of documents. It's basically the secrets of the tobacco industry just right there in your computer. So Adam and James, it's online. So Adam and James discovered this and they studied these documents and found out all of the decades worth of research showing, you know, all about, you know, the complex chemistry of smoke and how to design cigarettes and how to make them more addictive and how to make them more appealing. And so they absolutely studied those and were able to basically pick up where the tobacco industry left off and just, again, apply the Silicon Valley innovation model and run with it.
So, well, first of all, Oren Etter is our guest. The name of the new book is The Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation. As I read the title of the book to our listeners, The Devil's Playbook. So are these two guys, by playing with this playbook, they themselves devils?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, there are a lot of people in the world who are trying to demonize them. I believe that they started off believing that they could innovate on a deadly product and thought that they could save lives. The problem, where they ran into trouble is that, again, going back to the Silicon Valley model, they basically sold this highly addictive product in an unregulated market in a way that was, one might argue, irresponsible. They marketed it as a cool gadget, something that was flashy, something that was they marketed it as a fashion accessory. It was on runways. It was in, you know, fashion magazines. It was on a billboard in Times Square that was seven stories high. So are they the devil? No, I think that they really had major missteps that put them in a very difficult position. And now, frankly, well, they are their company that they built is really hanging in the balance. And we'll see whether or not the FDA will continue to allow them to sell their products.
One of the things that you point out is that when e-cigarettes come onto the market, you refer to it as the Wild West. It is so much that they're existing in a regulatory gray area. By the way, the tobacco industry is one of the most heavily regulated in the country. So the e-cigarette market is like, oh, well, we don't have rules. We can do this, 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 and this. And they did for a really long time and made a lot of money and made big deals with tobacco manufacturers. And again, going back to a previous question, and they did this in a really short period of time.
Yeah, and that was the most, you know, kind of shocking thing was that, like you said, the tobacco industry was one of the most heavily regulated. And here are these devices that the FDA just hadn't gotten its arms around. Like, they hadn't figured out how to regulate them. There was all kinds of litigation that prevented them from regulating them as medical devices, which they originally intended to do. The FDA tried early on to regulate them as essentially a pharmaceutical device, and they got sued by the industry. And as a result, they were kind of put into this gray zone where they were not going to be heavily regulated until Congress could come up with a regulatory scheme. Now, of course, Congress moves at the pace of a snail. And so as they're trying to develop these regulations, these companies are scrambling as fast as they can to just get it out there. So it was really a race between these innovators, right, who are wanting to sell a product whose business model is predicated on getting it into the hands of as many people as possible, and the FDA that's just, and Congress that's just kind of like, you know, doing what Congress does, which is move very slowly. So yes, they absolutely, it was this race. And in that kind of, you know, period before the FDA could come up with any sort of regulations, they flooded the market with their product.
Also, the number of kids that were using it were just amazing. You cite studies in the book that a third of American high school students and 10% of eighth graders were using e-cigarettes. man.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It just, you know, it was this combination of the highly addictive nature of the product, but also with the fashion kind of, you know, veneer that was over the top of it, but also the social media. The product was, you know, kids are on social media. They saw this thing, you know, I don't know, millions and millions of times and impressions on Instagram and Twitter and all of these spaces where teens live. And it just became like a snowball. So, yeah. And that was sort of one of the most heartbreaking things about this whole story is that, of course, after the tobacco wars, there'd been this huge effort to reduce youth tobacco use. And it had actually been working. Mm. Like right before the Master Settlement Agreement was signed, almost 40% of high schoolers were smoking cigarettes. By around 2010, it was less than 20%. So youth tobacco use had been cut in half and it was declining every single year. So suddenly you have the appearance of these new nicotine products and, you know, the numbers of, you know, kids using a nicotine product, a tobacco derived product started going up again. And public health experts were like, well, what the hell? Like, how is this happening and how did it happen so quickly? So yes, that was, you know, one of the, you know, really what made, I think, turn the tide as people started seeing like, wow, there are millions of kids using these types of devices. And this is not really what we intended. Like, you know, maybe we want to save adult smokers' lives, but at the expense of what? One of the most really interesting statistics to me is that more than 90% of adult smokers begin smoking before the age of 18. 99% of adult smokers begin smoking before the age of 25. 25 is when the brain is considered mature, fully developed. Right. So that means if you don't have the next generation, if you don't have the next generation of nicotine users, you're not going to have a product to sell. So it was, and that was kind of the industry, the public health experts, their kind of goal the entire time is to stop the next generation from becoming addicted. So it kind of stopped everything in its tracks and made everybody kind of have that opiate moment.
A huge part of this story, of course, is the flavoring of the nicotine and the fruit flavors and the dessert flavors that were offered. And then people said, okay, well, we'll take that off the market. Did that substantially reduce the usage among the kids that it obviously was being designed for?
Well, definitely taking flavored products off the market was like one of the most kind of like obvious things to do. Now, of course, the regulation was nuanced like most, and basically it says that you can't sell flavored pod products. So these are like little tiny little pods that are pre-filled that you snap into a device like Juul. They can still buy flavored products that you pour into like a bigger vape device or that's a single use device and stuff like that. But certainly taking the flavors off the market was a huge way to reduce youth use. And it probably did in some aspects contribute to that. Because frankly, like a tobacco flavored product just doesn't taste good. It's not appealing. But a gummy bear flavored product, it just tastes like you're just inhaling a gummy bear, you know? So I think that definitely the flavors are an attraction for kids, and taking them off the market have definitely, they've certainly cut into Juul's sales in a huge way. And, you know, certainly mitigate the risk of youth trying or initiating an e-cigarette or a nicotine product for the first time.
When you go to Juul.com, the first thing that comes up, it says our mission is to transition the world's billion adult smokers away from combustible cigarettes, eliminate their use, and combat underage usage of our products. What is their status now?
So they're basically in a holding pattern. They have, you know, kind of tried to change the messaging around this in a huge way and have tried to, you know, basically disown their, you know, the original screw up that they had with getting all the kids addicted. And, you know, they're trying to focus on the adult smokers. They've, you know, stopped using social media. They've stopped using the models to, you know, to model their product. And so basically they're in a holding pattern. They've had to submit an application to the FDA, just like every other e-cigarette company right now, which will basically, the FDA now determines whether or not their product meets a public health standard that would allow them to stay in the market. So basically, Juul is waiting to see whether, and they should find out in the next several months, but they're waiting to find out whether the FDA determines their product to be, you know, determines whether the product can remain on the market. So Juul's market share, like their overall value as a company was once valued at $38 billion. It's now valued at less than $5 billion. So the company is definitely a much, much reduced version of its former self. But it's being run by tobacco executives, former executives from Altria. They know exactly what to do. They know how to weather these storms. They've been through it before. So Juul has moved its headquarters from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., to me, an acknowledgement that they realize their future lies in the hands of the regulators. So, you know, they're doing everything they can to preserve this market, to preserve their products, and to hopefully live for another day.
The name of the book is The Devil's Playbook, Big Tobacco, Juul, and the Addiction of a New Generation. Lauren Etter is the author. Lauren, thank you very much for sharing with us. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Great pleasure having you on the program. Again, the name of the book, The Devil's Playbook. It is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.